You know, I mean, people like me who do pro bono legal work, generally you find that most of the pro bono legal work we do is sort of test cases, high profile things and so on. And the reason for that mainly is that if you can run a test case and you win, well then you help a lot of people in one go rather than just helping individuals one at a time. But community legal centres do an immense amount of what really constitutes pro bono work in ordinary cases for ordinary people every day of the year. And it's community legal centres across the nation who provide the help that people need when they need it and in circumstances where they can't afford to pay lawyers for it. People who work in community legal centres make an immense contribution to justice in this community, and I think that they really deserve to be recognised and applauded for what they do. I'll be quite candid and say the work which community legal centres do is far more important than any of the pro bono work that I've done, and I think that most other pro bono lawyers would agree with that assessment. Now, I have another reason for mentioning this, because one of the cases which is most important in my estimation that I've been involved in was a case for a community legal service in Adelaide, the Aboriginal Legal Rights Movement. They had a client wander in one day and ask him if they could help, and so they set up an action for this guy, and it drifted along for quite a while, and they had several changes of counsel, and eventually, 2 months before the trial was to start, their senior counsel was appointed to the bench, and so they were looking around for someone else and they contacted me. And I agreed to do it. It was for a bloke called Bruce Trevorrow. Bruce was born at 1 mile Camp Meningi on the Coorong in 1956. His parents lived at 1 mile Camp, just a little collection of humpies 1 mile outside Meningi, because in November 1956, in South Australia, it was illegal for Aborigines to live closer than 1 mile to a place of white settlement unless they had a permit. Now, that's where Bruce was born, but when he was 13 months old, on Christmas Day 1957, he got crook. And his father didn't have a car that was capable of driving him up to the Adelaide Children's Hospital, so some people from Meningi took him up there. And he was admitted to hospital on Christmas Day 1957. The hospital notes, which still survive, show that he was diagnosed with gastroenteritis. He was treated properly, and about a week later his gastro had resolved. And a week after that, the records show that he was given away to a white family who lived in suburban Adelaide. Now, that family had a daughter who was 16 years old at the time, and she remembered this very well, because her mother had always wanted a second daughter. And she remembered going with her parents one Sunday, instead of going out looking at display homes or going shopping, they went to the children's hospital to get a child. And they went there and they saw this lineup of Aboriginal kids, and they saw a cute curly-headed little girl, and they said, "We'll have her," and they took her home. And when they changed her nappy, they discovered she was a boy. That's how Bruce was given away. Now, for the next few years, the Aborigines department ignored him. But when his mother at 1 mile Camp Meningi managed to find a pen and a piece of paper and an envelope and a stamp and an address, she wrote to the department saying, "How's Bruce going and when can he come home?" And they wrote back to her, and the letter still exists, saying, "He's doing quite well, but the doctors say he's not well enough to come home yet. They've already given him away." And according to their own records, they actively prevented the mother from finding out where he was for the next 8 years. All the while, they had in their records a written opinion from the Crown Solicitor of this state saying that the Aborigines department did not have legal power to take Aboriginal children from their parents. And in the face of that advice from the Crown Solicitor, what they did, on their own admission, was simply to take children whenever they got the chance. Now, Bruce had a wretched childhood and a wretched adolescence. He ended up in state care at the age of 11 or 12, and by the time he came out of state care, he was a bit of a wreck. I don't need to tell you the rest of the story, except to say this. The case which was set up for him by a community legal centre was a case which sought damages on his behalf for the fact that he was stolen as a child. And it is the only case in Australia's legal history so far in which a court has found that he was in fact stolen and he was taken contrary to law and he suffered damage as a result, and the judge awarded him a total of about $800,000 in damages. Now, it's interesting that that case and the fact of the stolen generations attracts very little interest or concern in the Australian public at large. I mean, it was a great and wonderful thing when on the 13th of February 2008, the then Prime Minister, in the first sitting of the new Parliament, publicly apologised to the members of the Stolen Generations. Interestingly, Bruce's brothers, Tom and George Trevorrow, are leaders of the Ngarrindjeri community in South Australia. They were not taken because they didn't have the misfortune to be sent to hospital. Tom and George Trevorrow have grown up to be good, tough, strong, resilient, resourceful people, whereas Bruce, their younger brother, spent a wretched life not knowing who he was or where he belonged. The contrast between them could not be more striking. Well, of course, when Sorry Day was announced, Tom and George were invited to Canberra for the event, but the government forgot to invite Bruce. They had to be reminded that he was, after all, the only Aborigine in Australia who has demonstrated in a court that he was a member of the Stolen Generations, but they forgot to invite him. The reason for mentioning this is that I rather think, you know, we have to be a little charitable to the Aborigines Department of various jurisdictions back in the 50s and 60s and before, because there's no doubt that the reason they took Aboriginal kids was that they genuinely thought those kids would do better if they grew up in white suburban Australia rather than growing up in Aboriginal families. It was a view which they held sincerely, but which was wrong. It also ignored something which they knew, and the judge found that they knew, which was all the work of a person called John Bowlby in England, who had demonstrated that if you remove a child from their parents between the ages of about 9 months and about 5 years, you damage their ability to attach to people. You damage their ability to form relationships with people. And Bruce was a perfect example of exactly that. So here we have governments acting on an ill-conceived but genuine policy idea, acting in ways where they know that the result will be harm to the child, but thinking in some vague way that perhaps the child will do better if they grow up in nice middle-class white suburban Australia. How would we have responded as a community if white children were handed away in that same careless fashion because having grown up, you know, having been born to a working-class family in the western suburbs, there's an opportunity to hand them over to a wealthy family from the tree-lined streets of the eastern suburbs. Wouldn't we be up in arms about that? Wouldn't we be horrified to think that children were taken from their parents because they happened to go to hospital and given into richer families because that way they might do better? We'd be horrified. And yet, if they're only Aborigines, we don't seem to be nearly as concerned about it. And that's a theme which I want to return to a little later. You'll remember that in a year or two ago, we had a big consultation. The Brennan Committee inquired into whether or not we should have a Human Rights Act for Australia, or a Bill of Rights. Same thing. Don't think American Bill of Rights. That's not what anyone was talking about. Bill of Rights, Human Rights Act, the sort of thing that we have in Victoria, the Charter of Human Rights and Responsibilities, the sort of thing they have in the ACT, a Human Rights Act, something which protects and recognises the things that all sensible people acknowledge as important human rights. There were some major arguments against getting such a thing, against getting legal protection for things like the right to life, the right not to be imprisoned arbitrarily, the right not to be tortured, things like that. There were four main arguments put very vocally and repeatedly by a number of high-profile people against the idea of a Human Rights Act for Australia. They were, first of all, they don't work. Second of all, they transfer power from the elected representatives in Parliament to unelected judges. And third, that we don't need one anyway, because our rights are already protected by the common law. And fourth, that it would be a lawyer's feast. Now, I want to discuss each of those briefly because although I suspect that the idea of a Human Rights Act won't come on the national agenda for another decade, I'd like you to leave today thinking that perhaps we missed an important opportunity and that perhaps a Human Rights Act for Australia would be a good idea. First of all, the argument that they don't work. What that argument says is, well, look at places like Russia. Look at places like Rwanda. Look at places like Zimbabwe. They have bills of rights. But what a mess they're in. True enough. Is that because bills of rights don't work? Of course it isn't. It's because the rule of law has broken down. And when the rule of law breaks down, it doesn't matter what the statutes say. When the executive government acts as it will, regardless of what the law says, then a Bill of Rights is not going to save anyone. A constitution won't save anyone, no matter what your legislation says. If the executive government acts with disregard of the law, then no legislation will help. That's a failure of the rule of law, and that's the explanation for what we've seen in Russia, in Zimbabwe, in Rwanda, and so on. The second suggestion is that they transfer power from the elected representatives in Parliament to unelected judges. It's a curious one, that, because obviously the people who make that argument didn't actually read the Victorian Charter or the ACT Human Rights Act. Because what they do, essentially, is four things. First of all, they list a series of human rights which they acknowledge as essential to a dignified existence in a free, democratic society. And they are the sort of rights that I mentioned before. They do not include the right to bear arms. You'd be rest assured about that. They then say, OK, you, the bureaucracy, if you're a public... if you're a member of the bureaucracy providing a public service, you must do your job in a way which conforms to these rights rather than in a way that contradicts them. That's a really important thing because, you know, you see, for example, in the mental health area, you very often will witness treatment of people with mental health problems in a way that suggests that compassion has hardened into vindictiveness. And so something where the Parliament tells the bureaucrats that they have to act in a human rights compliant way is a very important reminder, and it means that many human rights problems can be solved at the coalface without ever going to court. The third thing they do is that they say to the Parliament, well look, when we introduce any new legislation, a committee has to look at that proposed legislation and say whether or not it unreasonably restricts any of the human rights which we've identified. If the Parliament says, yes, it unreasonably restricts some of those rights, they can still pass the new law, but there's a political price to pay because they've got to be fair dinkum about it and say, OK, we acknowledge those rights are important, we acknowledge that we're unreasonably restricting them in this new legislation, but we're doing it anyway. OK, so it makes them come clean about what they're doing, and that's pretty important. The fourth thing they do is that they say to judges, you, the judges, when you're interpreting legislation, if legislation is ambiguous, and let's face it, much legislation is ambiguous, if it's ambiguous and one interpretation of it would tend to support the human rights that we recognise and the other interpretation would tend to detract from those human rights, you should choose the interpretation that supports human rights. Now, do you think that's transferring power to the judges? It's actually telling them how to do their job. It's telling them the way they should go about the process of statutory interpretation. So those arguments seem to me to be completely fallacious, and they don't get any better just because the proponents kept on repeating them. I'm going to come back to the argument that they're not needed, but I want to touch briefly on the argument that they would create a lawyer's feast. And I like that one. It's my favourite anti-Bill of Rights argument because it's all based on a linguistic trick. I'm interested in language, And the trick is this. They never explain it. They just say it'll be a lawyer's feast. And people think, oh, that's a terrible thing. Why? Why is it a terrible thing? Let me explain. We all know that lawyers are horrible, nasty, money-grubbing, vile pieces of human detritus. And we all know that feasts are very nice. And we don't want something nice to happen to someone horrible. And so a lawyer's feast is necessarily a bad thing. You don't have to spell it out. It's just there as a trick of the language. The problem is that apart from being a neat trick of language, it's also wrong. And the reason it's wrong is that you don't get paid to do human rights work in Australia. People can have varying views about the legal profession, but even I don't expect that we're going to have a long line of lawyers all queuing up to do unpaid work. You know, it's just not going to happen. And experience in Victoria and experience in the ACT suggests that these new bits of legislation haven't created a flood of litigation at all. The acts have been used from time to time, but only modestly, and there certainly has not been any lawyer's feast. If they call it a lawyer's famine, that would be accurate, but of course it wouldn't have quite the same compelling force as an argument. Now, I want to come back to the first argument, which is that they're not needed. They're not needed because our rights are already adequately protected by the common law. As a lawyer, whenever I hear about the majesty of the common law, I go weak at the knees and I think, yes, wouldn't it be marvellous if that was true? But it's not. Let me illustrate it with a couple of cases that I've been involved in. The first, and the one which really got me sort of started on this path of real concern about human rights in Australia, was a case I did for a refugee family who'd come from Iran. They left in very difficult circumstances. They're a member of a minority religious sect, a pre-Christian sect, who are regarded by the majority as unclean. And we all know where that can lead. Anyway, they fled Iran in very difficult circumstances. They managed to get themselves to Australia by the usual path, down through Muslim countries, down to Indonesia, and from Indonesia with a people smuggler across the water. And they were banged up in the Woomera detention centre. And there, after about 12 or 15 months, they were all doing it pretty tough. Mum and Dad and the two daughters were doing it pretty hard. But the 10-year-old daughter, the older of the two, was really, really going under. So much so that a psychiatrist from Adelaide went and saw the family, and they interviewed the child and spoke to the parents, and they delivered a devastating report to the department. They said, this child is at extreme risk. You know, she has stopped caring for herself. She's stopped brushing her hair. She stopped doing her teeth. She stopped eating pretty much. She drinks a bit of water. She is careless about her clothing. She's frightened to go to the toilet because it's too far from the cabin in which they're living. So she wets herself during the day and she wets the bed at night. They said, this family must be moved to a metropolitan detention centre so the 10-year-old girl can get daily clinical help. 8 weeks went past, nothing happened. So they sent in a follow-up report in which they were even more punchy. And I think it's probably the toughest psych report I've read. And they made it very clear that this child was at grave risk and the family had to be moved to a metropolitan camp so that they could be, so that she could get daily clinical help. And it finished with the comment, a line I'll never forget, that the family had already suffered beyond the human capacity to endure in Woomera. Another 5 weeks or so passed, and eventually the department relented and moved them from Woomera in the South Australian desert to Maribyrnong in the western suburbs of Melbourne. And although the reason for moving the family was so that the 10-year-old girl could get daily clinical help, for the first 2.5 weeks of their stay in Maribyrnong, no one came to see her. It was as if they hadn't arrived. And on a Sunday night, in May of 2002, while her mother and her father and her younger sister were off in the mess hall having their dinner, this little girl got a bed sheet and hanged herself. Now, she was only little, and she didn't know how to tie the knot properly, so she was still choking when the family came back from dinner. And they took her down, and as soon as they took her down, she grabbed for a bottle of shampoo because she had seen adults try to kill themselves in Woomera by swallowing shampoo. They got the bottle off her easily enough. And she and her mother were then taken to Western General Hospital, where she was admitted to the intensive care ward. There were two ACN guards positioned outside the intensive care unit so that she would still be officially in immigration detention, even though she's outside the detention centre. Con Karapanagiotidis, who runs the Asylum Seekers Resource Centre, heard about this. He'd been looking after their visa application and legal affairs. He heard about this on the Sunday night. He went out to the hospital about 9:30. He said good day to the guards, who know him because he's a regular visitor at Maribyrnong. He said, I just want to speak to the mother and see if there's anything I can do to help. And they said, you're not allowed to see them because lawyers visiting hours are 9 to 5. And they sent him away. And he rang me at home that night and told me this story. And I thought, what is going on in this country? How is it possible that a child, a 10-year-old girl, can be treated so carelessly that she's driven to try and kill herself, and then someone who just wants to help is turned away at the door? It's just unbelievable.